Welcome back to the Emily Show. Today we are talking about the state of New Mexico versus Hannah Gutierrez trial. She was convicted on March 6th. We're going to talk a little bit about that conviction, a summary, what's happening now, what I expect to happen in the future as a shorter episode and kind of a roundup, if you will, of the key takeaways from the trial before next week's episode, which is going to be all about what this means for Alec Baldwin's upcoming trial and a check-in with all of the civil lawsuits in the Rust matter that are still pending that we heard a lot about during this trial. So let's get into it. Welcome to The Emily Show. I'm Emily D. Baker, the internet's go-to legal analyst and big fan of the cursy words. I've been a licensed attorney for over 17 years. I'm a former prosecutor, and I break down the legal side of pop culture and entertainment stories we can't stop talking about. We should just get into it. Let's go. And just a reminder, if you didn't check out my previous episode and interview with Sir Mix-a-Lot, please go and check it out. I have loved seeing your feedback on YouTube. It was a great interview, not just about the music industry, but some of his memories from working in entertainment for so long and where we see the music industry going and the future of music, and also quite a lot of inspiration for young artists, and I think for everybody. So if you haven't checked that interview out, be sure to do so. Let's talk state versus Hannah Gutierrez. The number one question I have been getting since this trial is, yeah, but what does this mean for Alec Baldwin? And I'm going to do a deep dive on that for next week's episode, but we need to talk about what happened in this trial to better understand what's going to happen in the Baldwin trial. Because the Baldwin trial, though different defense attorneys, same prosecutor, same judge, and a lot of the same witnesses. So we've gotten a really good preview of what's going to happen. If you remember, Hannah Gutierrez was charged after the fatal shooting on set of Helena Hutchins with one count of involuntary manslaughter, and that count had two different theories. She was later charged with one count of tampering with evidence, a count that even when it was filed, I thought was pretty weak. I didn't like the count very much. I don't think they had good evidence for it. And ultimately, the jury convicted her on the involuntary manslaughter, but not on the tampering with evidence. And I completely understand how the jury got there and think that given the evidence they had, that that was the right result in this case. Alec Baldwin is also charged with involuntary manslaughter. The different theories of involuntary manslaughter are going to be different for Baldwin, and we'll talk about that next week. But for Hannah Gutierrez, there were two theories because involuntary manslaughter has two different ways you can get to the same result. One way is, are you doing something inherently illegal? And the other way is, are you doing something that is legal and you did it in a way that is criminally reckless, negligent, and that even though you were lawfully able to do the thing you were doing, did you do it in a reckless and negligent way? So two different theories, and the jury doesn't have to agree on which theory. Theoretically, you could have six jurors go, well, I think she was doing her job as an armorer lawfully and loading the gun, but she did it really, really badly, really recklessly, criminally negligently. And that's how we see this, you know, involuntary manslaughter. But you could then have the other six jurors, to get to a unanimous 12, say, I think she was negligent completely in her handling of the firearm. That itself is a crime. So if she's negligent in handling the firearm, it doesn't matter that she's an armorer. That's a negligent use of a firearm. And that's the way she's guilty of involuntary manslaughter. So one count, two theories. And we don't really know how the jury came to that decision because we can't ask them. That's not within the purview of things you can question the jury about. And after the verdict was given, one juror did speak to the media. I covered it live over on YouTube. And that juror was talking about having a commercial driver's license and the safety standards that are required there, but also talked about working at the nuclear plant in Santa Fe, New Mexico, or outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. And it's interesting to me because if other jurors in the area work in high-risk jobs, work in jobs where safety is not just fundamental, but can be fatal. You have a lot of jurors who are like, yeah, but the witnesses said it was your job, so it was your job. And I really do think that's what happened here. We saw some key witnesses in this trial talking about what the job of the armorer was, but ultimately the best evidence against Hannah Gutierrez-Reed was all of her police interviews. It was the strongest evidence, not only that she knew what her job was, but that she knew she should have done it better. And what we didn't see, and that we had heard of in civil lawsuits and elsewhere, were that there were emails of her reaching out to production saying, I need help. I need more. I don't have enough armorer days to do my job safely. We saw none of that come up in her case. What we did see from the defense case was two, and I think there probably only should have been one, but was two of the OSHA investigators who wrote a scathing report about the set of rust, a report that I think is going to be really critical in not just the Baldwin trial, but in all the civil trials, because it places responsibility for workplace safety squarely on the shoulders of the production company and production and then the chain of command. But that's OSHA's job. Look at the chain of command, look at the employer, and determine if they did something wrong outside of safety protocols. And this set, from everything we've learned in this trial, was a mess. And Hannah Gutierrez was part of that mess and was not adhering to her own job's safety protocols. And at the end of the day, she had the authority to slow things down and to stop filming. We also saw some really unflattering video of Alec Baldwin, where he's yelling on set, he's hurrying people along, and the state is going to use those videos again in Alec Baldwin's trial, I'm sure, showing that he's not allowing those on set to do their job. But one of the state's better experts said that ultimately, if the actor checks the weapons, then the armorer has to recheck the weapon. And that's what one of the things Baldwin has been saying all along is, yes, I can check it myself, but then if I check it, the armorer has to check it again. And the armorer didn't seem inclined to do so, wasn't pulling the bullets out of the revolver cylinder to show that each one shook like it should, to indicate that it was a completely inert dummy round versus a blank round. Those are things that weren't being done on set. The thing, or one of the things, that's going to bite Baldwin is that we also heard from those working on set that Baldwin shouldn't have even been manipulating the gun the way he was in the church during this time. So the jury came back very quickly to convict Gutierrez. And after the jury rendered their verdict and were escorted out, it was a very, very quick verdict reading. It was so strange to me because the judge had the foreperson read the verdict. I was like, wait, what? Like, that's so much pressure. Like, oh my God. I don't know if that's standard practice in New Mexico, and any of you that practice in New Mexico, please let me know, or if it's just this judge. But I've seen judges and court clerks read the verdict, but I have not seen the foreperson go ahead and read your verdict. But that's what happened. No, they were not shown on the streams or anything like that. We just heard the voice of the foreperson reading the verdict, and they read through it very quickly. It's only two counts. And then they went on to detention or not detention. And ultimately, after very brief argument from Gutierrez's attorneys, she was handcuffed and taken into custody and has been in custody since March 6th. They have since set the sentencing date for April 15th. So mid-April, we will have a sentencing of Hannah Gutierrez. She is facing up to 18 months state prison. I don't think she will get the full 18 months. I don't think it's appropriate that she gets the full 18 months. I think going through the trial experience is probably warded her off of ever working in this industry again. I don't think she remains a danger to society or things like that. So when you start to look at the sentencing factors in aggravation to enhance a sentence or in mitigation to reduce a sentence, I think there's room for argument on mitigating factors here. This is an involuntary manslaughter. She did her job badly, and someone died because of that. But this was not a volitional crime. So it's a bit of a different thing when you look at it, which is why the sentencing matrix is maximum of 18 months. Could she get probation and time served? She could. Is a probation or parole period and a ban on her working with weapons appropriate? Probably. So we will start to see sentencing memorandums in pretty short order here, and I will be covering those and let you know when they are available. We've also seen her attorneys filing an emergency motion for new trial and a release that's largely based on a new state Supreme Court ruling that I will be covering over on YouTube after I've gone through the state Supreme Court ruling and Hannah Gutierrez's motion for new trial and release. The release asking that while they wait for the arguments for the new trial, she be released from custody pending that. We will see when they get a court date to argue that. But that ruling from the New Mexico Supreme Court just came down on March 14th. So this is in relatively short order that the defense is arguing that the ruling in that Supreme Court case will necessitate a new trial for Hannah Gutierrez. And again, after I've had a chance to go through that Supreme Court case, I will cover that on YouTube. And if you are in the Law Nerd app, you will know when I'm covering it. So if you have not downloaded it yet, lawnerdapp.com will get you there, or just go into whatever your app store is and search Law Nerd and you will find it. It is a free app to you, iOS and Android. I keep you up to date on not just new merch, live streams. If you're members in any of the member spaces, you will get notifications through the app when we're doing members only live streams. We actually have one the day this gets released. If you are a member, there will be a members only live, and you will be able to see real easily what's going on live stream, what's going on the podcast, and when we are waiting for things like verdicts. It will keep you in the loop when the verdict comes down. However, this trial, a little behind the scenes of trial mom life, this trial, Dr. B was coming home from work with G. I was going to pick up T from band. And that morning, I knew it was closing arguments on March 6th. And I looked at Dr. B. I said, I bet you this verdict comes down while I need, exactly while I need to pick up T from band practice. And you know what? I was pulling in to Travis's school as my phone started to explode with people telling me that the verdict was in. I was like, I knew they were going to come back quickly. And after closing arguments, I was looking at how long the jury had been out. And I was like, no, they're very well likely to come back this evening. And that's exactly what they did. So the verdict watch was a bit of a rush for me too. It reminded me so much of the Murdaugh case. That jury came back in a staggeringly fast amount of time, as sometimes guilty verdicts do. And I was still streaming when we got the verdict and notification in Murdaugh. I was like, wait, what? So I was surprised, but not surprised when the verdict came back that fast in this case, because I knew that that exactly was going to happen when I needed to pick up my kiddo. But the app will keep you in the loop for all of those things. Trial, we have another trial. Sentencing is April 15th, and I will start covering the live day-to-day coverage of the Karen Reed trial out of Massachusetts on April 16th or 17th, depending on what's going on with jury selection, how long jury selection takes. But we'll start coverage of that case with opening statements. Generally, when cases are streamed, they do not stream the voir dire questioning of the juror part. So that will be the next trial next month. I mean, it's like less than a month from when this goes live. So it's like there's going to be a lot of trials happening between really now and the summer, because we have the Karen Reed case out of Massachusetts, and I will do a podcast episode with a brief background. There's a lot of information in that case, and I imagine a lot of information that's not going to come in to trial. And I really want to examine that case based on what's presented to the jury and go through that with you as jurors watching it unfold. So we'll do a brief background, but we're not going to do a rabbit hole deep dive of that case before it goes to trial, just because I think there's a lot in that case that the jury may never see. Then we have things happening in May. The Britney Spears trial is supposed to be going for her 12th accounting, which is not a trial she'll be present at, I don't believe. The lawyers will largely carry this out. It is really to determine the facts and bring witnesses and examine and cross-examine them about where the money went from Britney Spears's conservatorship estate in that 12th accounting, what expenditures were made and things like that. And then Tom Girardi is supposed to go to trial, though it looks like they're already trying to punt that out a bit further, and I won't be surprised if they do. Then in July, we have the Baldwin case, Rust Part 2 coming up for trial, and we will see a lot of the same witnesses that we saw in Hannah's trial. I imagine that the Baldwin trial is going to take us a little bit longer than this did, because this case, on theory, is a little different. It was Hannah's job to be responsible for the weapons. So Baldwin's team is really going to focus on, right, but it wasn't Baldwin's job to check the weapon. It wasn't his responsibility to make sure the gun wasn't loaded. But actors do pull triggers on movie sets. And then it's going to be a battle, I think, of some of the experts of whether or not pulling the trigger while pointing a weapon at someone is that negligent use of a firearm that is the illegal grounds for the involuntary manslaughter. But all in all, with the Hannah Gutierrez trial, we saw that the prosecutor really has a distinct style that I'm interested to see if she shifts strategy for Baldwin's lawyers, if this was a strategy because of who the defense lawyers were, or if this is her kind of her default of how she asked questions. It was unique to me that she left quite a lot of her direct examination for redirect examination, but there's always cross-examination. It'd be interesting if Baldwin's lawyers start holding her feet to the fire on that and just saying outside the scope of cross, and shut some of that down, because she did leave new ground to be tread in redirect, which is not what you're supposed to do. It's supposed to only respond to cross-examination. She was quite fierce on cross-examination of defense witnesses. It seemed to be where she was most comfortable. We saw that with a lot of the questions on direct examination being very leading in nature and the defense just letting it be. I don't know if it's because they just wanted to get to the point or if they didn't want trial to take longer, but there were a lot of moments in this trial that were unique. Every live trial is. It's one of the reasons I like covering live trials so much. You never know what's going to happen in a trial. And I used to come home from work and look at Dr. B. I'm like, you're never going to believe what happened today in court. And it's a whole different thing when I get to do that live with all of you and go, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. But there were moments in court where these attorneys, Hannah's lead defense attorney Bowles and the lead prosecutor Carrie Morrissey, were snipping at each other in court, like bickering in court, not making objections and letting the court rule, but like arguing with each other in front of the jury. And then the judge's response was like, this is not hyperbole. The judge's response was, I let you have coffee in court. Like, you need to calm, like children. I let you have coffee in court. I need you to calm down. I need you to stop. And then the court started really cracking down on the lawyers and how much exposition happened in front of the jury, and made them come up to sidebar for every objection. So we didn't even hear the grounds of the objections for the last bit of trial. And I imagine we're not going to see that repeated in the next trial. But it was a little bit of the Wild West in that courtroom for the first few days of trial, for sure. And I was stunned at the way the attorneys were snapping at one another just in open court. And then half the time, the judge wouldn't even rule on the objections. The attorneys would just like move on. It was baffling. And the appellate record is going to be interesting to see. And we'll see what happens with this motion for new trial and whether or not this new Supreme Court case really does cause an issue for Hannah's case on legal grounds that causes it to come up for a new trial. And I wonder if it really does, whether or not they will find a way to settle, because of course you can find a way to settle the case, or you can go to trial again. With the swiftness of that verdict, I don't know if the defense would really want to go to trial again, but we'll see what happens there. And I'll be keeping an eye on that over on the YouTube, and you'll know about it in the Law Nerd app. So all in all, it was a very interesting trial. It moved witness-wise pretty smoothly. There was definitely some ordering of the witnesses. that I would have liked to have seen done in a way that you could understand the story a bit better. And I know by the time we get to the Baldwin trial, because the prosecution did wrap it up very well in closing and connected the dots quite well in closing, it'll be interesting to see how that flow works in the Baldwin trial. I felt like there were details that I didn't really see where she was going with them until closing, which sometimes is frustrating for me. I like to be able to piece it together like a puzzle while we're going along in trial. But there were quite a lot of details tracking where ammunition came from. And I don't think we will see that in the Baldwin trial. We just won't need to. Tracking the ammo becomes much less relevant when you say the armorer loaded the weapon and then what happened. And I think the prosecution said Baldwin's name as much, if not more, than the defendant's name in this case. So I imagine we won't be focusing very much on what Hannah Gutierrez did, because what Hannah Gutierrez did, a jury could look at it and be like, well, if it was her job to check the weapon and it's not Baldwin's job to check the weapon, then didn't you already like prosecute the person who's responsible? So I can see them de-emphasizing Gutierrez in the trial against Baldwin, even though they emphasized Baldwin in the trial against Gutierrez. It'll be interesting to watch them. It's unusual to see defendants split like this, but they had dismissed Baldwin's indictment and then refiled, which is also interesting. So there's a lot of unique qualities to this. And of course, when you're dealing with a movie set, it is really inconceivable that you end up with a death in this manner on a movie set in the first place. And that is something in this trial that really came across from the witnesses that were there. It was palpable, even through the screen, the trauma and the pain and the sorrow and really the disbelief that this could have happened from the witnesses that were there, including director Joel Souza, who was also shot with that same round that went through Helena Hutchins and killed her, but injured him and got lodged in his shoulder. From him to the script supervisor, to the EMT who was on scene, to one of the camera dolly grips, it was just really heartbreaking to see all of their testimony about how this went down that day on set and what they all experienced. And we're going to see that and more in the next trial. With all of that, I hope it gave you a little insight to this trial and kind of summarize. Emily, did you summarize the witnesses? I hope so. We saw a number of experts from the prosecution, a very good weapons expert from the prosecution whose testimony I thought was illuminating. And of course, we saw from the witnesses we were waiting to see, like Dave Halls, the first AD, who got that sweetheart plea deal right at the beginning of all of this and already done with his 6 months of unsupervised probation, to Seth Kinney, who operated PDQ arm and prop, who provided the blanks and dummy rounds to set mostly, and Sarah Zachary, who was the head of props, who was almost working as an assistant armorer, and then Hannah was working as assistant props. So the two of them were both each other's supervisor and subordinate. It was odd and unusual, and you could tell there was not a lot of love lost between the two of them, not just in Hannah's police interviews, but also in Sarah's testimony. But really, the key evidence against Hannah Gutierrez were the interviews given by Hannah Gutierrez. I was really surprised that the prosecution didn't use her words against her more in closing arguments, because she said quite a few things in her interviews that showed so strongly not only how much she knew what her job was, that she knew that she was the last line of defense for safety on set when it came to the weapons, but that she also knew it was her responsibility to intercede when weapons were on set, and she wasn't doing that. And the thing that stood out from all of those interviews is when she just shakes her head and said, I wish I would have checked them more. And I think everyone on that set, the family of Helena Hutchins, and everyone watching this unfold in the film industry also wishes that she would have checked them more. This case was completely avoidable, and it's very, very sad. It never should have happened. And there were so many people in a position to stop this from happening that didn't. And that's why this case is being prosecuted. Next week, I'm going to deep dive into what's going on with the civil lawsuits with regard to Rust, what's going on with the Baldwin case. There are some new motions filed there, and we will talk about all of it in the next one. So thank you for being here. Thank you for being a Law Nerd. Say it with me. May your Wi-Fi be strong. May your toilet paper or bidet be plentiful and spritzy. May your spring break for your kids be lovely if you've had it or not. My feet still hurt from Disney World. May your family be well, and may the odds be ever in your favor. Law Nerd, I will talk to you in the next one. Bye. You can stay up to date with everything I'm covering on our free iOS and Android app at lawnerdapp.com or search your app store for Law Nerd. And you can also follow me on social media at The Emily D. Baker. Remember, I stream on YouTube on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I recap all of that for you in quick bits on Monday. And of course, The Emily Show drops on Wednesdays. Thanks for being a Law Nerd.